Very excited to be here. This is a lot of fun. I'm going to talk today about a new class of models of supersymmetry breaking that I worked on with Patty Fox, who's that guy right there, who's at Washington but is leaving us to go to Santa Cruz, and then Ann Nelson in this paper right here. And I'm aware that not everybody in this room spends all of their time staring at Susie Lagrangian, so I'll try to be technical, I'll also try to be general, so that I don't leave anybody completely behind. So, the basic overview is this. People like to talk about supersymmetric theories, and the basic reason is the hierarchy problem, as those of you who think about beyond standard model physics know. But whenever you start talking about supersymmetry and supersymmetry breaking, you encounter the Susie flavor problem with a type of supersymmetry breaking which is known as soft supersymmetry breaking. So I'm going to review what soft supersymmetry breaking is, why it's necessary, why it introduces a new problem that we have to solve, and then I'll segue into this new class of models. Now, I'm not talking about a particular model, so some of the statements I'm going to make are going to be vague, somewhat vague, but I'll try to be as specific as I can. And these models are considered gauge extended models, because we're going to take the gauge sector of the MSSM and enlarge it to have an n equals 2 supersymmetry multiplet in it. I'll discuss the UV insensitivity of this theory and why that's a good thing, which we're terming super soft supersymmetry breaking, is this very UV insensitive supersymmetry breaking. I'll discuss some consequences, what makes it different from the MSSM, how electroweak symmetry breaking works, how grand unification continues to work, and then depending on time and how hot it is, I'll discuss CP violation and phenomenology at the very end. So for those of you who don't care about such things, let me just remind you of what the hierarchy problem is. The hierarchy problem, very simply put, is the point that within the standard model, there are various diagrams which renormalize the Higgs mass squared, which are quadratically divergent. So if we think of this as an effective field theory, the natural scale of the Higgs mass should be something like a loop factor down from the cutoff, wherever the new physics should arise. So given that we know the size of the VEV of the Higgs, we can expect that the new physics should happen somewhere around a few hundred GeV. We need some new physics which is going to control that divergence and cut it off. So these are the diagrams in the standard model which contribute. You have these gauge loops which contribute to divergence. The most important one, I think, is the top quark loop. And then lastly, there's the ordinary Higgs quartic loop. And all of these things will give you quadratic divergences. So you need some physics which is going to cut off all of these diagrams. You can't just cut off one of them. You really need some new physics that's going to cut off all of these divergences. And one possibility is supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is going to add the partners, super partners, with opposite statistics, so they contribute in loops with the opposite sign. So where you have gauge loops here for the Higgs, you now have gaugino loops, which cancel that. Where you before had top loops, you now have stop loops, which also cancel that. And this term comes from the special type of the potential, which is the D-term portion of the potential, and that cancels because the sum of all of the charges of fields which transform under that gauge group are zero. So that's all fine and good. Supersymmetry as an idea sounds very nice, but we haven't seen any supersymmetry. So we just say, well, then it's just, it must be broken. That's how we, in beyond standard model physics, think about symmetries. We invent a new symmetry to solve a problem, but we don't actually see the symmetry, so we break it. So if it's broken, these superpartners must appear somewhere around a few hundred GeV. That's where they should appear in order to cut off the quadratic divergences. These loops should become relevant at a mass scale of about a few hundred GeV. But we need to know how supersymmetry is actually broken. And the way that it's generally broken, the requirement that we make on it, is that supersymmetry breaking be what's called soft. But the whole point of introducing supersymmetry is to solve the hierarchy problem. Then if we break supersymmetry, we don't want to reintroduce quadratic divergences into the theory. Logarithmic divergences are okay, because even if the cutoff is the Planck scale, that's just a factor of 10 or 20 in a logarithm. quadratic divergences are what we really want to avoid. And so soft supersymmetry breaking is defined by supersymmetry breaking which does not reintroduce quadratic divergences. And there are various ways to write down soft supersymmetry breaking, but we generally understand it as being broken spontaneously. So we have some chiral superfield. The notation of supersymmetry when you write down supersymmetric Lagrangians is to have a superfield which has bosonic and fermionic components. So this is a scalar component, fermionic component, and then, of course, the auxiliary component, which acquires some F component VEV, and that breaks supersymmetry. Then there are various soft terms you can write down, which I'll just list here. There's a scalar mass squared, so just some mass for the scalars. A gauge-eno mass. The gauge-eno is the fermionic partner of the gauge boson. Scalar trilinear terms, so squark, squark, Higgs, or A terms. And scalar bilinear terms, which you can write down for the Higgs, so just H up, H down in Lagrangian. And I've written it in superpotential language here for a very particular reason. So what I write down here is some product of chiral superfields, and I extract different components. Here I extract the theta, the fourth component, here the theta square component, and here. And the black part is a part that essentially appears in your Lagrangian regardless. This Q dagger Q piece is just the kinetic term for your squark. This WW term is the kinetic term for your gauge fields. This QUH has the symmetry structure of your Yukawa couplings. And this mu H up H down term is something that you need to have in your theory in order to make sure that the Higgs-eno has a mass. And then I'm simply making it proportional to this supersymmetry breaking. So the red part is the supersymmetry breaking, and the black part is the supersymmetry preserving and necessary part of your Lagrangian. So if I can write down the SUSY preserving part, it's generally very difficult, at least for some of these operators, to avoid writing down the SUSY breaking part. That is, if I can write down a kinetic term for my squarks, then I can also write down a soft mass for them if I have this supersymmetry breaking. And that sounds fine, but this actually is precisely the SUSY flavor problem. If I write down an arbitrary mass matrix for all of my squarks, then I can write down mass mixings between up squarks and and charm squarks and stop squarks. And that flavor violation leads to problems, signals that we should have seen. Two prime examples are a decay of a muon into an electron and a photon, which would occur when a muon goes to, say, a beno, and then I have some mass insertion where the smuon goes to an s electron and emits an electron, or contributions to KK bar mixing, so where I essentially have the same thing, where I start with an S and a D, I guess it should be a D bar, and I have mixing in these diagrams between the flavors, and that contributes to the mixing of KK bar. And if it's CP violating, will contribute also to the CP violating portion, epsilon sub K. And we don't see anything like this. So that already tells us something very important about supersymmetry, if it's there, which is that we need very highly degenerate soft mass squareds. And I've also listed, just for completeness here, there are some other constraints coming from DD bar mixing, BB bar mixing, B to S gamma, and then, of course, you've heard probably a lot about G minus 2 of the muon, and then EDMs of electrons and neutrons. So we know there has to be a lot of structure in the supersymmetry breaking, and we don't know how to get that, because you can't just insist on that from a symmetry that the rest of the theory respects. So that sounds tough enough, but there's more. Even if I could solve the SUSY flavor problem at some very, very high scale, at the Planck scale, say, and I write down a theory where everything is completely degenerate and everything satisfies all the properties that I want it to have, if there's any physics at intermediate energy scales that knows about flavor, that distinguishes electrons from muons or ups and downs, then as I evolve down, I'm going to reintroduce this flavor problem. So it can appear that I've solved the problem, but really, I can reintroduce it with just generic physics at intermediate energy scales. Of course, if you just assume that there's a complete desert and no physics at all between here and in the Planck scale, then you can be okay.
Question, so is this correct to understand that you're saying that you cannot make the supersymmetry breakdown very small because you would have to bring the superpartners down? You would have seen them already?
That's right. That's right. Well, so there's different issues. One is, if I bring this I have to have some minimal amount of mass, because I would have seen them in colliders, I would have produced them, and I just would have seen squarks and sleptons flying off at LEP or at the Tevatron or something like that. But then even if they're heavier than that, even if they're heavier than that, and I have somewhat random mass matrices, so no real structure to them, or even relatively high structure, but not exact structure, then these precision experiments, which do not actually see the squarks or the sleptons or the superpartners, but just see their indirect effects, would have gotten contributions which are much higher than what's been seen. So we know that diagrams like this and this are not contributing. Now, if I took the mass of these particles arbitrarily high, say, you know, just for a number, 1,000 TeV, or maybe even higher than that, actually, something like, you know, say, 100,000 TeV, then these diagrams would decouple regardless of the structure of the mass matrices. But then I would reintroduce the hierarchy problem, because there would be nothing at a few hundred GeV cutting off the quadratic divergences that appear in the standard model. So I need to have them relatively low, but if they're relatively low, then these things should be happening, and these things aren't happening, and that tells me that if they're there, they must have very, very degenerate mass matrices, so that these sorts of transitions, these insertions, don't occur.
So these things should kick in at 600 GeV, this number, and the interaction.
Something about that, yeah.
So your remark on this movie insensitivity, I think it's somehow okay unless you have some new flavor violating local interactions which operate over a wide range of scales. Unless we have such computation, then just have the standard model of coupling.
If I just have the MSSM and I write down universal flavor masses at a high scale,
yes,
and I assume that there is no other physics that knows anything about flavor.
Well, but still, you can have some physics, but the whole point is that as a result, you don't have some more or less large flavor masses.
It's actually not that large. It's not that large. Those diagrams that I wrote down, if I wrote down arbitrary masses, are in excess of experimental limits by about 5 orders of magnitude, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I really need really, really careful things. So even a finite effect at some intermediate mass scale that was not log enhanced would be too much.
But in any case,
so I can always assume that there's nothing there, and that's perfectly reasonable.
Okay. What I'm saying is that still you can have a lot of new teachings without introducing new flavor violating local interactions.
Certainly. I could introduce a new gauge group, for instance,
yes,
and that would not be flavor violating. But if I do have fields which know about flavor,
okay,
is all I'm saying, then that is a serious, serious problem. So our goal is going to be to construct theories which have this UV insensitivity, that don't care about what physics is up at the high scale, so that I can really make definitive predictions. So let's just review what the solutions to the Suzy flavor problem are. I'm going to discuss 3 sort of generically, and then, of course, there are subcategories and subheadings and modifications. There's gauge mediation. That's sort of the classic one, which was done by all these people. This is UV insensitive above some messenger scale M, but it has something of a mu problem, although there are solutions, and it has fine-tuning issues. It's a technical problem that I'm going to. It's not a dead model by any means. It's very alive, but it certainly has issues. There's anomaly mediation, which was discussed by these people, which is very UV-insensitive, but that's actually sort of a difficulty for the theory, because it predicts that the sleptons have negative mass squares, so they're tachyonic. They would naturally acquire a VEB and break electromagnetism, and the stars wouldn't shine, and there would be no chemical bonding or anything like that. So if you want to avoid the negative slepton masses, then you have to put in new physics, but since it's UV insensitive, it really tries to resist the new physics that you're putting in to solve the problems. So you generally have to introduce UV sensitivity in order to solve these problems, although there are some very reasonable solutions. And last is Gaugino mediation. Gaugino mediation is this brain roll setup where I put Gaugino masses on one brain, and I'll put in the gauge fields propagate in an extra dimension, and we live on another brain sequestered from the supersymmetry breaking. And then as I just run down, the gauge interactions feed in soft mass squares to the squarks and sleptons. So it's completely UV sensitive, but that's not necessarily a terrible thing, but it's certainly something we'd like to avoid. And it has some tuning issues. Those are the solutions. So This is all within the context of the NSSM. All right, so I take the standard model, I have my quarks, my leptons, I have my Higgs, and I have Schwarz's leptons and Higgs xenons, and I have my gauge fields, I have my gluons, my W's and my B, and I'm going to add gluinos, winos, and binos, and that's sort of the minimal extension.
Excuse me.
That's sort of the minimal extension that I can add. That's just precisely adding one field, one superpartner field for everything. That's the minimal amount of supersymmetry that I can have. Excuse me, just one second. This is not staying on. So, I want to think a little bit outside the box, right? We've had n equals 1 supersymmetry, so one supercharged generator for all these generations. And if a little bit of supersymmetry was good, then more supersymmetry should be better. So what I'm going to advocate is that we at least consider the possibility that we're going to have n equals 2 supersymmetry in certain sectors of theory. And how important... Yes? I'll come to that in a second. Now, if I do n equals 2 supersymmetry in the entire theory, so I add n equals 2 partners for all the matter fields, as well as the Higgs fields, as well as the gauge fields, then I encounter certain problems. For instance, I'll hit a Landau pole. That's just too much matter. I'll hit a Landau pole at just something like 1,000 TeV, which is very, very near. And that's not a good thing, because if I want to talk about a theory which is UV insensitive, it would really be ideal if I had a UV to which I was insensitive, and that would not be the case there. And then there are issues like, how do I get chiral matter? Quarks do not come in vector-like pairs. Leptons do not come in vector-like pairs. The Higgs does, but the matter fields don't. So it seems that the minimal n equals 2 extension that you can have is one in which you just add n equals 2 content for the gauge sector. So we're going to talk about gauge extended models, where we have n equals 2 content for the gauge fields, but not for the rest of the thing. So it's partially extended supersymmetry, not completely extended supersymmetry. So that's what we want to do. We're going to try to think outside the box and break supersymmetry in a different way. Now, the entire time I was talking to you about supersymmetry breaking, I argued that we are going to parameterize supersymmetry breaking by an F-component BEV of a chiral superfield. But that's not the only way to break supersymmetry. I could break supersymmetry with a D-component expectation value of some vector superfield, which is parameterized by its supersymmetric field strength here. Now, it's very difficult to use this in the MSSM to write down realistic supersymmetry breaking. But now that we have this N equals 2 content, where I said before, we have the matter fields here under N equals 1, we have the vector fields here under n equals 2. I've added an adjoint chiral superfield, which is the n equals 2 completion of it. And now that I've done that, I can write an operator in my theory, which is a coupling W prime WI times A. Now let me explain what this is. W prime is some U1, some new U1, a hidden sector U1, which is going to acquire a D-term BEV. It's not hypercharged. It's a different U1. It's the Suzy braking sector. And this is going to couple the field strength of the standard model gauge fields to their chiral adjoint partners, their n equals 2 partners. What does this operator do, precisely? Well, the most important thing that it does is it generates Dirac gauge enomasses. All right? And this is not something that we are pointing out for the first time. This point has a nice history, going back to 82 with Polchinski and Suskin. Dinah McIntyre noted this in 95, and Jack and Jones noted that you could get a Dirac gauge enomass from this in 99. What we're going to focus and study, which has not been considered, is what the renormalization properties of this term are. So let's look at first exactly what it does. What does it do? Well, if I take a theta from here, the D term, I extract a theta piece from here and a lowest component piece from this, or a theta piece from there and a lowest component piece from that. If you're used to Suzy breaking Lagrangians, then that all is trivial and I didn't need to say it. And if you're not used to them, then it was gibberish. But this is what you get. You get a Dirac mass coupling the gauge eno to the fermionic component of A, a Dirac gauge eno mass, and this coupling between the D term and the real part of the scalar component of A. That's off shell. On shell, we have that gauge eno mass, a mass term for this scalar, and then a new scalar trilinear between this field A and whatever fields are charged under the gauge group in question. So now you might think, well, that looks just like gauge-eno mediation, right? In gauge-eno mediation, I give mass at some high scale to gauge-enos, and then I run down. And that's how it works. And so here it seems like I'm giving mass to the gauge-enos at a scale m, and then you would expect that I would run down, and I'll have the same UV sensitivity. I'll just have essentially the same spectrum. Why am I even talking about it? And actually, oh, sorry, go ahead.
You said you want to extend the gauge sector, mm-hmm. supersymmetric gauge sector by n equals 2.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just enlarge the degree of freedom, or you still constrain all interactions in the gauge sectors to the n equals 2 supersymmetric?
So what I'm going to do is, for the purposes of writing down and doing calculations, I'm going to make the constraint that it's n equals 2, except for maybe soft breaking, so giving some masses to these fields. But in reality, given that I know that I have explicit breaking of it, I would not expect a realistic model to have true n equals 2. So at the largest part, it is just the enlargement of the sector. But I really want to think of these things as being paired up with the gauge sector, and that's why they have these interactions together.
So as for the interactions, you just use n equals 1. And most generally, n equals to supersymmetric interactions, although you have the n equals...
I think that a realistic model, you would have to allow generic n equals 2 violation in it, I think. I don't see any reason why it would not be there. Yes?
Does the
imaginary component of it. Well, let me discuss this quickly, and then let me comment back on that. All right. We want to understand the radiative effects of charged fields in this theory, and these are the ordinary gauge loops, and this is essentially the ordinary gauge-eno mediated loop. But the point is, even with the Dirac mass, it looks the same. But we have this new scalar trilinear interaction. And it turns out that when I add these all together, I get a completely finite result. There is no log divergence in this at all. And I've just written down what the expression for the soft mass is here, group representation factor, gauge coupling, loop factor, small logarithm, and then proportional to whatever the gauge-eno mass is squared. And this is very remarkable, because we've really introduced Suzy breaking at a very high scale, but as we've run down, we have not introduced any scalar masses at all until we come to the low energies. And this is very important, because if you have intuition, if you've built up intuition about Suzy breaking models and how they work and what's reasonable and what's not reasonable, this completely goes counter to all of that. For instance, you're usually thinking, I can't have very, very heavy gluinos, because heavy gluinos feed into squarks, and squarks feed into Higgs, and that reintroduces the hierarchy problem. But that's not the case here, because there is no running. If I have a very heavy gluino, I can run all the way down, and I have no contributions to scalar masses until I get down to the weak scale, and then instantly I turn on scalar masses for the fields there. So all of your intuition about what introduces fine-tuning into the theory really go away, because there is no RG evolution above the scale of the gauge-eno mass. And that's very, very, very different from the MSSM. Now, because this is just a loop for any generic charged field, all of the fields which are adjoints under the gauge groups are also charged under them and will get a finite contribution to them. So the scalars will become massive except for the imaginary component of the extended superpartner of hypercharge, which is just a singlet, because an adjoint under a U1 is a singlet. But all the other scalars will get masses. And the gauge-enos, you can see, are all massive. So you'll have a massless decoupled scalar in this limit, but actually I'm going to argue later that that's not a very natural limit, that really these things should all have additional mass terms. So this will kind of evolve as we go on.
Are the two loops also finite?
That's a very interesting question. In fact, I would argue that it is not just one loop finite, but that it is, in fact, all loop finite. And this is sort of a very strong claim. But there's a very simple way, I think, to understand this. We can just use a basic Spyrian analysis. The only way that I've included supersymmetry breaking into my theory is by writing down theta MD. That's the only way that I've included it. So now let me ask questions about the scalar masses. What sort of ways can I use this Suzy breaking Spyrian to write down soft scalar masses? This, I think it's very easy to convince yourself, is the only way to pick out the scalar component Q star and Q. But it goes like MD to the fourth. It has the wrong dimension. I want a mass squared. So that if I'm calculating a loop diagram, I have to introduce another scale into this. And the only other scale I have is the cutoff. So that means when I take my cutoff to infinity, this term will vanish. Equivalently, the argument would go like this. If you go and you lock yourself in a room for as long as you need, and you try to write down a local counterterm, you will find that you cannot write down a local counterterm that involves just D-term breaking. And that is why you cannot have any divergences, because of course if there were a divergence, then you would have to have a local counterterm into which you could absorb it. So, the basic framework in which we want to work is as follows. We're going to have a model which has a gauge sector extended to have n equals 2 content, and we refer to these as gauge extended models, or GEMs, which have the extended superpartners, which are these adjoint fields, which are the n equals 2 partners of the gauge fields, or ESPs. In this model, we're going to have the only source of supersymmetry breaking be a U1 prime D term, and that is what allows us to have super soft supersymmetry breaking instead of just ordinary soft supersymmetry breaking. And as I argued before, it's very different from usual SUSY models. For instance, your gauginos are a loop factor heavier, which is very much like Schirk-Schwarz theories, actually. And in fact, some people argue that this is a way of deconstructing Schirk-Schwarz, but I'm not going to go into that. There's no running of the soft mass squareds. That should be masses, not mass. And that ruins your intuition of how fine-tuning works in these theories. It's very, very different. And like I said before, this is a class of models. This is not a particular model. The different different operators that you introduce in the superpotential, and we'll find also the different grand unified extension of it, will make different predictions. But in general, there are certain features which are uncommon, such as these. And they make it a very interesting theory.
Do you have any dynamics generating this D term?
The D term or the operator which couples them?
The D term.
The D term itself. I'll come to that. There's some important details. I can write down other operators involving these fields. I can write down this operator of W prime times that. This is a scalar bilinear term for the adjoint field. It'll push up either the real component or it'll push up the imaginary component. One of them goes up, one of them goes down. But it is still super soft. This also does not introduce any divergences into the theory. And I can introduce a Majorana mass for this ESP field. Now, this mass is forbidden by an approximate R symmetry of the theory, but that approximate R symmetry of the theory is broken by the presence of a mu term for the Higgs. So given that I believe that there is a mu term for the Higgs, because I have not seen Higgsinos, I sort of expect, not only do I expect this mass to be there, I expect it to have a mass roughly of the order of mu. So something like the weak scale. And within a factor of 10, I'm not going to say anything beyond that. Then there is the question of how n equals 2 is n equals 2. This was your question earlier. All right. For instance, we know that n equals 2 theories have very, very interesting renormalization properties. And this theory has very, very interesting renormalization properties. Is that because this theory is n equals 2, or is it for some other reason? Well, the Spyrian argument seems to be independent of the fact that I have n equals 2 fields. But on the other hand, I could never have written down the Spyrian in the way that I did unless I had the n equals 2 fields. So how significant the n equals 2 is sort of unclear here. But I think it is very instructive when you're talking about building microscopic realizations. If I wanted to go out and build a brain model, for instance, people go out and try to build string brain models of the standard model of the MSSM, and they encounter certain difficulty, I could build different brain models where I had n equals 2 sectors for the gauge fields, for instance, if they propagated in an extra dimension. So it's sort of instructive to think of the n equals 2 structure as maybe having a true origin in the higher, in the microscopic theory if I wanted to build microscopic realizations.
Hello, it seems like that you just introduced the adjoint chiral complex with specially tuned couplings.
Specially tuned couplings.
Yes.
These are sort of very generic couplings.
What I'm saying is the gauge sector n equal 2 means that we have additional n equal 1 adjoint chiral multiplex, and it's coupling to other vector multiplex to be special.
Right. So That's a question of whether or not those fields are contained. So the only thing that could be would be the Higgs, right? Because the Higgs is the only thing that fills out an n equals 2 representation. And then there's the question of, is the Higgs part of an n equals 2 sector of the theory, i.e. does it propagate in an extra dimension as well, in which case I would expect those couplings to be there, or is it confined to a brain, in which I might expect those couplings to be there, but I would not necessarily have the relationship of gauge couplings to those that I would have in n equals 2 theories. So, let me point out to you what I think is the biggest concern. It turns out, although it looks like this is the best theory ever, there are some problems. It turns out that if you integrate out the scalar fields, these real scalar fields that have these new scalar trilinear interactions, it actually cancels off the quartic interactions for the Higgs that arise from D-term potentials ordinarily. So, I ordinarily have this quartic interaction, now integrate out this real scalar, and I get zero. And that's bad because the quartic coupling is ordinarily very important for stabilizing the Higgs potential as I move out in Higgsvev. So let me have a few comments. Having spent a lot of time thinking about whether or not I should really worry about this, I've decided that I don't have to. There are some reasons. One is this cancellation is incomplete once I put in a finite Majorana mass for these extended superpartners. Since I kind of believe that that is a necessary ingredient of the theory that should naturally appear there, I do not actually expect this cancellation to really occur. Also, a very big difference of these models from ordinary MSSM models is that I can have very heavy squirks. And in fact, they're very generic to have very heavy squirks. And those can radiatively generate quartic couplings, which are large enough to give me what I need for a Higgs potential. And lastly, NMSSM-like couplings, like a singlet coupling to H up, H down, can appear very naturally here, and they will enhance the quartic coupling.
So you're saying even without this NMSSM-like coupling, you still have a sufficiently predicted boson?
Yes. I mean, it's all, of course, dependent on what the parameters I write in are, but yes.
The Higgs mass depends crucially on the quartic.
Yes, that's right.
So it's generated only radiatively.
Well, either radiatively or by a combination of radiative effects and incomplete cancellation. But there are situations in which even with zero ESP mass, I have a big enough quartic coupling in order to have the Higgs mass evading the 115 or 114 GeV bound coming from LEP. And of course, it's not entirely clear what the bound is because this is a SUSY Higgs and 114 is for a standard model Higgs. So what I'm going to be talking about today are mostly standard model-like Higgses, so I think that the 114 GeV bound is a good benchmark. But so I think the upshot is, I don't think that this is a problem, but it is very, very different from the MSSM, and you can't look at MSSM Higgs mass limits and look at Higgs mass limits in this theory.
Why is that? What's different, actually?
Just because the quartic coupling is different.
Right, but the bounds actually come from...
Oh, no, I mean, like, if you look at... Yeah, no, I mean, if you look at certain regions of parameter space of the input parameters, that it would appear different. So let's discuss briefly what some microscopic origins of this theory might be. This is, after all, a brain worlds and supersymmetry workshop, so this talk would not be complete if I did not write down some brain worlds. So here they are. We live here, the standard model. Here is supersymmetry breaking. This is the sort of, by now, very familiar sequestered supersymmetry breaking pattern. In this case, I could have both large F terms and D terms on this brain if I had a U1 propagating in the bulk. If the U1 propagated in the bulk and 3, 2, 1 lived over here, I could write down that operator on this brain just mediated by supergravity. Or I could have 3, 2, 1 propagating in the bulk and the U1 on this brain, and then matter fields would not feel direct couplings to the F terms. But you can convince yourself there are various permutations that you can work out with different effects. But this is certainly one microscopic realization that gives you this sort of a setup. And like I was saying before, I think it's very interesting that this N equals 2 gauge structure, the presence of these fields, really is sort of hinting. It really wants you to be thinking about extra dimensions. So I am. Yes?
So your N equals 2 gauge structure is on the SF brain?
So there's different... That's why I was saying there are different permutations. I could have it living in the bulk. I could have living it in an orthogonal direction and a U1 in this direction. Or I could have it living on the brain, and then I wouldn't really understand why it was N equals 2, but I could do it.
What's your matter sector?
The matter sector better live on the brain. Matter sector better live on the brain because it's chiral.
So then you have two kind of rings. One has N equal 2 supersymmetry, and one has N equal 1.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it depends on, I mean, this is all a question of where the gauge fields live, right? Because the gauge fields are the only thing which really have to have the N equals 2 structure. So if they lived on the brain, then I would not have a good understanding of why they have N equals 2 multiplet structure. Only if they live in a bulk, only if they live in either this extra dimension or an orthogonal extra dimension do I really naturally understand it. But of course, I could just write down N equals 2 structure on a brain, and you can't stop me. I'm just saying there are different permutations, and in different circumstances, it appears more natural than in others. But they don't have to be the standard model gauge fields. I could have some broken U1 that could just define what is standard model fields, right? I could have intersection of brains where the brain which is defining the gauge field that you're talking about is just some U1, and then I get chiral matter because I have the additional brains which intersect that, and then the strings which attach the two brains could give me chiral matter. I mean, that could be...
Right, but brain engineering is very constrained.
Yeah, well, brain engineering is very constrained in string theory. But we don't know how to do very much in string theory. And so I can just say if we go to the strong coupling limit, then we don't know anything at all. No. This is supposed to be... I have not sat down and tried to do a string construction of this. I'm simply saying that the fact that you have N equals 2 motivates you to consider certain types of string constructions, just as the fact that you have chiral matter suggests that you think about certain types of string constructions for chiral matter. So. Nobody has a good string construction of the standard model yet, and yet I'm really willing to...
There's some ad hoc construction, but I don't see how you can have both N equal 1 and N equal 2 gauge theory and then N equal 1 method in string theory.
In string theory. So you object to this idea of having intersecting brains where fields are localized on the defect or the chiral matter and that gauge fields propagate in a different brain.
But then your whole system will have one... You can either pick N equal 1 or N equal 2 supersymmetry. You cannot have both.
Right, so I would have... The preserved supersymmetry would be N equals 1, but the matter content would be N equals 2 of the gauge sector.
It's okay.
Yeah, usually the presence of the brain bricks have a supersymmetry, so some fields living on that word volume preserves only half of the bar volume. So.
But it doesn't mean that I'm eliminating the field content. It's just telling me what the couplings and the restrictions on the couplings I have are. Unless I do an orbifold projection, and then I really have gone to N equals 1. But I'm not talking about that.
You know that in these kinds of models, generically, UV sensitivity reappears with the quadratic regression via the Lebesgue term at 1.
That's only true if I put in scalar fields in the bulk where I do a twist such that I end up with differing levels of scalar fields, right? You're talking about Nilis's argument.
If there is any U1, then...
I think that's only true if I include charged matter fields in the bulk and I do a Schirk-Schwarz twist. I don't think in this circumstance I'm going to get any quadratic sensitivity at all. You're talking about, like, Barbier-Hall-Nomura type divergences.
If there is a brain localized scalar, then you do get a correction at that brain.
If I have a brain localized scalar, but presumably these come in pairs to cancel anomalies, and then I would not have quadratic divergence.
Okay.
I mean anomaly cancellation generally preserves or prevents.
My question is related to the generation of data. I mean the breaking of
switch
in your mind.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay. So. How could we have had a D-term? Well, I've just illustrated instances in higher dimensions where you can have D-terms but sort of not think about the F-terms. You might want to think about it in 4D. One possibility is that you just write down a Phi Eliopoulos term. You might not like this because once I couple it to supergravity, it seems like it's not gauge invariant any longer, but in terms of an effective theory, I can still write it down. I don't understand the origin of it, and I certainly don't understand the smallness of it. So within the effective theory, you can do that. If you want to talk about microscopic realizations, then it becomes more difficult. Alternatively, I could have a low-scale origin. This operator that I wrote down was a non-renormalizable operator, so it's suppressed by some mass scale. So I could have integrated out fields well below the gravity scale to generate this operator. And this is an example. If I write down some fields which are charged under the standard model, which couple to these adjoint scalar fields like this with a trilinear and are charged under this U1, so they're vector-like, then doing this diagram precisely generates those operators I was talking about before. And philosophically, this is very similar to gauge mediation, because the F terms would be present, as with the D terms, but the D terms are the only things which become relevant in coupling to standard model fields. So the point is, there are a variety of ways to do this. I don't know that I have a favorite one. Certainly from a model building point of view, you have to choose one to go with it, but since I'm just talking about a class of models, I will talk about all of them. There's also the question of grand unification. One of the things we like very much about supersymmetric models is the fact that the gauge coupling constants seem to unify if I take the appropriate normalization. And I've now added adjoint fields for 3, 2, 1, which is not a complete gut multiplet, and so should spoil that. But if I really believe this was embedded in a gut, then I would not merely have added these 3, 2, 1 adjoint fields, because I believe that if these field strengths are part of a gut field strength, these adjoint fields are part of a gut adjoint. Maybe it's it depends on the group, but some gut adjoint. And then if I think about what the mass matrix is for these fields when they couple to it, there's now some Higgsino field of some field which is breaking the gut down, maybe a 24 in SU5, and that will marry the Gaginos of the off-diagonal fields in the gut. And I'll end up with a mass matrix that looks like this. And if you look at this, this has a zero eigenvalue. And that means that these gut completions, if you will, are naturally massless. And when I say massless, I mean massless up to the Majorana mass, which I put in, which violates the R-symmetry. So these fields would like to have married the gut Gaginos at low energies, but the gut Gaginos have decoupled. So they have no one to marry. And so we consider these fields to be bachelors and designate them by this letter BI. So what are the possibilities? Well, I think the simplest possibility is SU3 cubed. Then I add bachelor fields, which are doublets with these hypercharges, singlets with these hypercharges, and then complete singlets. And that's the equivalent of adding three flavors to my system. So the theory still is perturbative at the gut scale. Alternatively, I could have worked in SU5, where I add these colored fields, these colored bachelors, and they're the equivalent of five flavors. And if you think about guts, you know that adding five flavors leads to strong coupling up at the gut scale. So this is a very complicated scenario, and I really need to start talking about two-loop couplings, or two-loop running, additional trilinear couplings in the theory, and so on, to make any sort of sense of this. But a few points. SU3 cubed, because it has a singlet, or four of them, has good dark matter candidates. These look just like Beano's. So that's sort of a nice feature of the model. And SU5, like I was saying, it's very difficult to make quantitative statements about it, but we can make some very good qualitative statements about it. And I think the quantitative statements would be very interesting. And one very exciting possibility that comes from all this is we go out and look, and we can actually see the gut completions at low energies, and we could see what the structure of the gut group is just by scattering it at TEV, and that's a very exciting possibility because we all know that proton decay experiments have not done a great job of telling us what the gut is, just telling us what it's not. So what about Higgs physics? The hierarchy problem is all about the Higgs, so I can't give a talk about the hierarchy problem without talking about the Higgs. There's that usual top loop contribution to the Higgs mass that I was talking about before, and it appears here. So you have a one loop Higgs mass which goes like alpha 2, you have a two-loop which goes like alpha 3, but these actually end up being comparable size, and just like in gauge mediation, if you spend any time thinking about gauge mediation, the two-loop beats the one-loop, and the two-loop is negative, and it drives electric symmetry breaking. But one nice thing is that this is a relatively small log in the theories. It ends up just being a factor of a few, rather than in gauge mediation, where it's usually a factor of 100 in the argument, not the log itself. And that generally improves the fine-tuning situation as compared with gauge mediation. I must, of course, comment on mu, the mu term, because that's still the Higgs physics. I need to have a mu term. I don't think that I want to go into too much detail. One possibility is if the D term is about 10 to the 11th GeV squared, so that is, I'm talking about supergravity mediation, then I can do Giudice-Mazziero via the conformal compensator, which is some amalgam of these three papers, where I just write down a chiral superfield bilinear in the Kähler potential, which ordinarily would not do anything for me, but because it's coupled to supergravity, actually induces both a mu and a b mu term. And then there are various NMSSM-like possibilities that you can also build. So, I should also discuss spectra. I put this in quotes because I'm assuming many unrealistic things. One loop running, gut unification, no violations of the n equals 2 structure, which I actually believe should be there. I'm not assuming any ESP Higgs couplings, which should also be there. I'm going to change everything. Then you have these sorts of spectra. This for SU5 and this for SU3 cubed. I had originally reversed them, hence the lines. And it's sort of what I told you. You have very, very heavy gauge enos, and then your scalar field's a loop factor lighter. And your squarks are extremely heavy, and that's why you can have this radiative contribution to the Higgs potential.
What's the value of MZ for this number?
The value of which?
MZ.
In this one, MD is actually equal to M2.
M2.
Yeah. But of course, it's all sort of, yeah. That's a value that I write down at the gut scale, and these are values at the low scale. Briefly, the phenomenology depends on the LSP a lot. It can be a singlet bachelor or a gravitino. It also depends a lot on the NLSP, which can be a Stau or a bachelor. It depends on the couplings. If I don't talk about bachelors at all, there's a bachelor parity, and how they decay and whether they decay depends entirely on what couplings I write down. But some interesting things, which you don't happen in usual supersymmetry, are long-lived Staus, long-lived hadrons, Beano-like dark matter with non-MSSM-type couplings. And moreover, the fact that we have Dirac-gauge genomasses instead of Majorana-gauge genomasses means that a lot of precision tests will not apply here, because they preserve an R symmetry. Again, very briefly, but for the sake of completeness, let me discuss CP violation. Alone, heavy gauge enos and degenerate squarks will solve the Suzy CP problem. So any contributions to Suzy CP will be gone in this scenario because of that. But there are relative phases in the new terms that I've written down. I've ignored them up to now, but they certainly could be there. I can rotate them out of this one, but they're left in these two. And they won't be in conflict with any current experiments, but they do raise at least the hope that future EDM experiments will see something. So, let me conclude by getting outside the box, by thinking slightly non-MSSM. We can extend the gauge sector, and we can construct realistic models of supersymmetry breaking involving only the D terms. These models are very different from MSSM models because they have no UV divergences in the scalar masses squared. That's the super soft property. And are, as a consequence, completely insensitive to any physics, any flavor physics that I put into the ultraviolet. The flavor problem is solved, and the spectrum is very unique, and the phenomenology may give insight into unification. So, thank you.